on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
But for me, body horror is a movie that focuses intently on the ways the body can fall apart, the way the body is vulnerable, and specifically the way the body betrays us to do those things to itself. This book was written right before The Substance came out, or else that would have been the parade example of it, because that really is all about the way our body betrays us, first by aging. And then we see that turned into an elaborate, detailed, really visceral metaphor with all of the ways that these bodies are growing, changing, falling apart, doing all sorts of terrible things. So for me, the distinction between something like torture and something like body horror is that body horror is kind of the body revolting against the individual and doing it to yourself. So body horror brings up all these really interesting questions about who am I and where am I, and do I really have control over my own body? And maybe how that control is more limited than I wish it was. So I talked about some places in Leviticus where I remember was at the Society of Biblical Literature a couple of years ago, where a scholar named Ryan Higgins, who fantastic scholar of Bible and horror, presented a paper where he had the main claim that in the priestly texts of the Pentateuch, God is disgusted by our bodies. And these texts then attempt to make us disgusted by our bodies too.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I welcome back author and biblical scholar Brandon Grafius to discuss his latest book, Scared by the Bible, The Roots of Horror in Scripture. The conversation touches upon various horror subgenres such as body horror, slasher films, apocalyptic horror, and their parallels in biblical texts. Brandon also delves into how horror can help us confront societal fears and values. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Brandon Grafius is Associate Professor of Biblical Studies and Academic Dean at Ecumenical Theological Seminary in Detroit. In addition to his teaching, he is a noted scholar, author, and speaker. As an author and academic, Brandon is known for his expertise in the fields of both Bible and horror. He is one of the few, if not the only, members of both the Society of Biblical Literature and the Horror Writers Association. Brandon completed his undergraduate degree in English at Michigan State University, then continued on to an MA in English with a concentration in creative writing at the University of California, Davis. After earning his first graduate degree, Brandon took a few years away from academia, returning in 2006 to pursue his Master's of Divinity at Ecumenical Theological Seminary. He earned his PhD from Chicago Theological Seminary. A revised version of his dissertation has been published as Reading Phineas, Watching Slashers, Horror Theory, and Numbers 25. He is also the author of Reading the Bible with Horror, A Lurking Beneath the Surface, Horror, Religion, and the Questions That Haunt Us. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, Scared by the Bible, The Roots of Horror in Scripture. Brandon, welcome back to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on again, Nick. I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, as am I. I really enjoyed the first time you were on the program and loved Lurking Beneath the Surface. And I enjoyed the new book, too. I finished reading it yesterday.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
And I made it all the way through, even the appendix. And in the very last thing you said, if you make it through, you're the kind of person I'd like to have a drink with. So maybe sometime.
Absolutely. Hope we can make that work.
Yeah. So, but I, you know, as a academic nerd, I appreciated all of that content in the back.
That was fun. It's certainly supposed to be a book that's readable and fun and engaging. Yeah. And then, so I saved all the footnote kind of material for an appendix at the end for the people who really wanted to geek out. Cause I thought there might be some readers that enjoy that bit of nerdiness there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and it is, and you know, the Lurking Beneath the Surface was this way too, but it is a very accessible book. This is not a book written
for academics, right? It's a book, I think, that's written for people who have an interest in the genre of horror and people who have an interest in the Bible and what horror may say about the Bible and whatnot. But I thought that maybe that would be the place for us to begin, is talking about horror as a genre and horror as a genre in the Bible. Because as you noted in the book, the Bible contains many genres in it.
We often have this idea that there is a genre that is like Bible, that that's its own genre, and it's stories of a nice God who is supportive and kind to people, and people who generally are nice to each other and try to listen to what God says and learn about how to be good people. And that's what this genre of Bible is, that we read these stories for moral edification and upliftment, and so we can get closer to God. And then we run into stories of people going to war and killing each other and behaving in less than admirable ways. And sometimes we don't know what to do with those stories. So one of the answers I've found over the years is that people don't read them. You kind of ignore those and focus on the stories that are happier and easier to digest and take something positive from. And to me, that's a real problem, because we're missing part of our tradition. From a comparative religion perspective, it leads us to think that it's only the other traditions that have bad stuff in them, because we only know the nice stuff of our own tradition. But it also leaves out so much of the richness. And then when we do encounter those, whether it's in our own study, whether it's in church or wherever that might be, it can lead to a real, almost like, what would we say, religious paralysis, where we just don't have the background, the experience, the tools to really process this material. So my first argument in this book is that we really need to engage with the Bible, warts and all, so to speak, horror and everything. That includes the happy poetry, the great stories and parables, and also the parts where humanity and even God are portrayed as less kind and warm and fuzzy.
Right. And you have a couple of questions that seem to guide the book in terms of reading the horror sections of the biblical text, which is, what is the story trying to scare you with? And how is it trying to scare you? And then you have a third one kind of that's connected, is what does this mean? So, what is the, and this is very broad because I would imagine that different sections of the biblical text and we can talk about this a little bit because there's this common misunderstanding that the Bible just kind of like plopped into existence, I think, by most people. But that's not the case. And it the writing took place over, I think, what, like 1,000 years or something like that,
No, at
if
least,
not even more. So maybe we can talk a little bit about the, I guess, the construction of the biblical text and how might I want to say this, the horrific aspects or the horror aspects to it.
So you've hit on what one of my main ideas is that because there is so much horror in the Bible, we should first recognize it as horror. That's the first step. And then the second step is taking what we know about how we interpret horror and kind of applying that. So I think horror often works by scaring us with particular, what would we say, anxieties or fears about our own lives. And it's, as I talk about in the book, and lots of people have talked about elsewhere, there's the monster. We're always scared of being carved up by Michael Myers or attacked by a werewolf or whatever, but there's usually something that is just underneath that. The haunted house movies almost always have as a subtext economic anxiety. Like the reason the family just doesn't run when they realize their house is haunted is because they've sunk all of their savings into this place and they don't know where else they're going to live. So many horror movies are about generational trauma, about fears that we haven't behaved well, and that those mistakes and bad things we've done in the past have ripples into the present that we maybe can't escape. These are things that are real life terrors that for a lot of us we worry about. Some of those in particular, we maybe stay awake at night and we try to figure out how to organize our lives to mitigate those a little bit. So when you can really think about what is this horror story trying to scare me with, that tells us where the story is coming from, what its view of life is, what its view of how we should be organized as a society is, how we should treat each other, what we should value. I guess that's maybe the best way to put it, is that the particular fears that a horror story is getting at really help point us towards the values the text is trying to help us understand or interrogate. And I think the Bible uses horror in really similar ways by offering to scare us with, as an example, the book of Job. It scares us with the idea that maybe humans aren't as important as we like to think of ourselves as being, and that there's a whole world that exists, lives, breathes, moves without us, that the world is a lot bigger than Job ever could have imagined. So by starting to ask these questions, it gets at what we value, what's important, and really how we're supposed to imagine the world.
Yeah, I love the Book of Job. You connect it to this genre of cosmic horror. And I love that. That makes so much sense because the Book of Job is such a difficult book. And in terms of the answer to the question of theodicy, and I personally don't like the answer that's given. I'm very critical of it. But placing it in the context of cosmic horror, I think helps kind of like take some of the to dampen a little bit of the criticisms that I have, I suppose.
I think that's a good way to look at it. Yeah, in the book of Job, we know Job has had all these calamities suffered in his life, and we as readers know that it's because God and Satan had a wager about whether Job would still be faithful after he lost all of his wealth and privilege. And Job spends the whole book lamenting and arguing with his friends about why this is just and how he can be having all these bad things happen to him when he doesn't do anything wrong, and saying he just wants an answer from God. Finally, in the end, God shows up, and either it has to be an answer in some way, but God doesn't directly address Job's question in the way we might wish. Instead, God kind of takes Job on a tour of the world. And it's a tour that's focused on all the places where humanity not only doesn't go, but it really isn't welcome, concluding with the depths of the ocean and this lengthy, it's a whole chapter long description of how cool Leviathan is. So in some way, the answer to why do we suffer is Leviathan. I think that's kind of fascinating. So it really forces us to reflect on what is the connection between this speech and Job's suffering. And one answer has always been God saying, "Well, I'm bigger and stronger than you, so I can do what I want." And that to me is upsetting and also insufficient. It's just kind of a God as a bully. But instead, what I think when we put it into the context of cosmic horror, we can see that it's really God trying to expand the horizons and say, "Yes, I know you're suffering, but that is coming from such a limited perspective. And let's look at a slightly broader perspective that places that into the context of the entire cosmos."
Yeah, I always read my point of view is the bully God, you know, who are you, puny little mortals to question me? What did you do? Did you create everything? No.
And that's I think that's there. And there certainly is this sense that Job's suffering doesn't really matter. So I think even if we look at it in cosmic horror and find all these wonderful philosophical things about it, it's probably still a terrible text to use for pastoral care.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Because
Well, but I
we
like,
do want our suffering affirmed, and we want our experiences affirmed, and the book of Job kind of resists that.
Well, and I do like, and you address this in the book as well, but kind of that focus on the Leviathan, it always amuses me that in like I've got the New Standard Revised Version that I usually use, also the Jewish Study Bible, but in the NSRV, there's a little asterisk when it gets to Leviathan, and when you look down at the bottom, it's like or crocodile, but yet then it describes Leviathan as essentially a fire-breathing dragon. And I always make the connection with Leviathan to the in the Enuma Elish, and you discuss this a little bit because it's often said that when you go to Genesis 1, where God is hovering above the deep, and that's Tehom, and it's always said that Tehom and Tiamat are cognate, but it is this idea of, if you look at the Enuma Elish, it's this idea of placing order on disorder, on chaos, and that's kind of what God is actually doing in Genesis 1. And I find that really interesting in terms of this idea of the cosmic horror, is because the face of the cosmos seems to be so chaotic, that is chaos, and that is sort of the root in many ways of cosmic horror.
I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, we have this idea that God creates out of nothing at the beginning of Genesis 1, and I don't think that's what the biblical text says. In the beginning, the world was formless and void, which is not nothing. It's chaos. And I think your connection with Tiamat and Leviathan is absolutely right. Am I right that it's the Enuma Elish where Baal defeats Tiamat and then splits her in two, divides her and
It's
creates
Marduk.
the that's Marduk. Thank you. Thank you. Excuse me.
Marduk.
Yeah. But there's this image of cutting Tiamat in half and dividing her to form the heavens and the earth. So, which is exactly how God is described as creating the heavens and the earth in Genesis through that act of division, dividing the water from the land.
It's the
So
firmament. Her body makes the firmament, and then the body of the earth.
So there's no battle with the dragon in Genesis 1, but it's almost God defeating chaos through just this immense power of speech, that God in Genesis 1 is so powerful that I don't even have to fight chaos. I can just order it around.
For sure. So, I kind of want to step back a little bit too, in terms of the biblical texts and how we read horror in a sense, because, you talk about how we have to, you always have to place it in the context. And you don't address that, you do address this story, but I want to bring in something else with the story because it's the story of Dinah. And that the way you present the story is that, she, and I, please forgive me, I forget some of the details here. But it's all about Shechem, which had been it's a person, but also the capital of Israel, right? The northern kingdom of Israel. And that you can tell the story if you want for anyone who is unfamiliar. That way, I'm not going to slaughter it because that's probably what'll happen.
So yeah, basically Dinah is, you have Jacob and all his brothers, and Dinah is the one sister, and she goes out to a nearby town to it seems like probably to visit a friend. And in the history of interpretation, there's a lot of blaming her for going out on her own. But then she gets found by Shechem, who is a kind of local ruler, prince, something like that. And he decides he wants her for a wife. So he at the language seems like he basically takes her and rapes her, and then feels really bad about it afterwards, so tries to marry her. And her brothers are furious. They work out a scheme where they pretend to say that, well, your town, you guys, you can marry our sister, but only if you'll agree to circumcise yourself so that you'll be able to be part of the Jewish community. The townspeople all say, yeah, sure, that sounds good. So they circumcise themselves, and while they're in the midst of recovering from their wounds, Jacob's brothers all come and attack the town and take their revenge and take Dinah back. So I put it in the context of kind of a rape revenge story.
Right.
And all of those issues that arise around revenge and guilt. Because I think one of the things that always strikes me about those kind of revenge movies is there's always some acknowledgement that this is not the best way to do things. This is not how things are supposed to be. And I feel in a lot of the stories of the Bible that same sense of sadness that this is where we're depicting the reality of human relations, but man, this is not good, and this isn't how things are supposed to be. And for me, it's really important to kind of open our minds up to the idea that the Bible doesn't always depict things as they should be. Sometimes it depicts things as they are and as we wish they weren't,
Right.
and challenges us to reflect on that and maybe do better in our own lives. You know, we're probably not going around attacking villagers, but we do hold grudges, and we let these feuds go on and simmer in smaller ways that aren't the best way to live and the way to relate to one another.
Oh yeah. Well, we do go around attacking villages, but that's a whole
Okay,
other topic.
I guess you're right. Yeah, that okay, and
I
even
do.
individually, we fund the attacking of villages and all these things, so yeah.
I do want to come back to some of the things that you said, but I want to linger just for a second about this story of Dinah and Shechem, because my understanding, and this is all within the window of the context, and I don't know if this is anything you considered with the book, because there are a lot of what they are called like doublets, stories that are told more than once. And this is a story that's told more than once. And, you know, biblical scholars, you know, they have, especially for the Torah, the first five books, they use just basic, you know, that there's like this E-text that stands for Elohim, because that's, they prefer that name for God. And that typically is associated with the Northern Kingdom of Israel. There's the J text, which prefers Yahweh, which is thought mostly comes out of the Southern Kingdom. And it's what I understand is that you have these this story of Dinah and Shechem, where the J text, it is that massacre where they go in, but in the Northern Kingdom, Shechem is just bought. They just buy the city rather than have the massacre. And I thought this is so interesting in the sense of how one story is told two different ways to two different audiences, and one lends itself to a horror narrative where the other one doesn't.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And there are a number of times, like there's a story in the Book of Kings where there's a siege against the people, and one of the stories is that, well, an angel of God came and struck down all of the invading army, and they drove him away. But then we read in the Book of Chronicles that, well, the king of Israel just kind of paid him off and paid tribute, and they went away that way. So yeah, we do have this kind of tension of whether it's a geopolitical situation or whether there's something more supernatural happening, and that supernatural element always leads more towards horror. And then one of the fascinating things is that it's, especially in the case of Dinah, the Kings one, there it's really told two times in two different places, once in Kings and once in Chronicles. But in the story of Dinah, it's like interwoven into one story, so it's difficult to pull apart and not quite apparent whether these existed as separate stories at one point or what each story was. I think that's a big debate in biblical studies right now about whether there were all these different documents that were put together, or whether there's like one base document that then was supplemented with some different things. It's the way the book got put together is a little mysterious. You alluded earlier to the idea that we think of it like a book that someone wrote in the beginning and then didn't stop until they hit Revelation. And yeah, it's much more complicated than that, and a couple hundreds of years worth of work of trying to unravel like what did these texts look like originally. And we have some ideas and some possibilities, but it's frustratingly opaque still.
Well, it just kind of dinged when I read it, because I thought that it was so interesting that reading some of these stories as horror, you know, can provide so much insight to those communities as well. And especially in instances where there's like debate about, you know, the origin of the stories or whatnot. And that's why the story of Dinah, kind of, I was familiar with that, and that there were two different versions. And I thought, it's so interesting that we can look at the text in different way. What does that tell us? Looking at it as horror, what does that tell us about the potential or the possibility of these two different communities? And so that it can open up the text even more than what most scholars are actually used to.
Yeah, I love that reading. And I think you're absolutely right that often, especially in Genesis, we're talking about individuals, but we're also talking about whole communities. These are often stories that are trying to set up to talk about why are our relationships with these people the way they are. And so we have this story here. We have this story about Noah and his children, all of the different stories that establish how these different tribes, different groups of people came to be, and why they maybe are clashing and conflicting with each other today.
No, I think it gives invaluable insight. So, something that you talked about or mentioned just a little bit ago is how some of these stories tell us about the world that we live in, and that it could be better. And also, there's this vision of how things can be improved. And that, I think, feeds into the apocalyptic narratives. And you have a whole chapter, and I'm always fascinated by apocalyptic texts. And there are many inside and outside the Bible. So I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about the nature of apocalyptic horror and the biblical text.
So the apocalypse, as I'm sure you know, that word comes from unveiling. We think of it as meaning destruction of the world, but that's not really the focus of religious apocalyptic texts. It's about having the curtain pulled aside so we can see how reality really works. And the answer is kind of that our reality mirrors the reality in heaven. That there are conflicts between different forces, and once those conflicts get resolved, our world is going to be remade, created in a new fashion. We see that most clearly in the book of Revelation with this vision of a new heaven and a new earth at the end. I mean, it's easy to overlook that in the midst of the dragons and all the other monsters that come and fight with each other. It really is like a destroy all monsters kind of a text. And I do think that kind of fits with our more contemporary genre of apocalypse as well. Like I've written in Lurking Under the Surface, I wrote about The Walking Dead as being really a TV series that asks us to look at what do we hope for? So if everything was destroyed and you had a chance to do things differently, create a new society, what would it look like? And sometimes the answers are that, well, we'd recreate the same thing and do it just as poorly as we did the first time. But in other times, you see people really trying to build something new that's going to, avoid some of the mistakes that we've made in that have gotten us to where we've gotten now. And for me, horror really is the genre that pushes us towards that imagination. That realization that where we're living is there are some pretty scary things about it, and it's not great. So what would we want it to look like instead?
Well, and it seems like that, at the core of apocalyptic texts, and I would wager that most apocalyptic horror is hope. That, if there's no hope, then, there's no message, and it's just, despair. And I think The Walking Dead, I don't know, I stopped watching The Walking Dead. And I know a
Think that's
lot
a
of
rational
people,
choice.
I think a lot of people stopped watching because it felt hopeless.
I think that's true. And I feel like even the most hopeless apocalyptic narratives are the ones that end with the most hope. For me, the one that it plays it almost for laughs, but the Cabin in the Woods is really apocalyptic horror that ends with the people deciding, this system is not one I'm willing to support. I'm not going to sacrifice anybody. And it's maybe, I think the last line in the movie is maybe it's time for someone else to have a turn. And even that is an imagination of maybe humanity is irredeemable, but maybe something else can arise afterwards that is a better way of living.
Yeah. Isn't it the old gods that are coming out?
Yeah, the idea is that there's this ritual that we have to do every year to keep the old gods at bay, and finally the main characters decide that this is not worth it anymore.
The elder gods, which takes us back to that cosmic horror idea.
Exactly.
And if I remember correctly, that was he's been canceled, but that was Joss Whedon who also created Buffy. So there's always Apocalypse and Buffy every season. But there's hope. Buffy always gave hope, I think. So let's talk a little bit about some of the other sort of stories that genre, horror genres, I mean, I guess sub genres of horror they're in. I did want to ask a little bit about monsters because you've talked about monsters. You talk about monsters in the text, and there are the the monstrous in the Book of Revelation. You also talk about the monsters in another apocalyptic text, which is the Daniel. So tell me a little bit about monsters and what do we mean by monsters and what's the role and the function of them in these texts?
So another book that I have out this year is one that I co-edited with John Moorhead, The Oxford Handbook of Biblical Monsters. And the first question I often get when I talk about this is, are there really enough monsters in the Bible for a whole book? And the answer is absolutely. But this question then comes up of why monsters and what are they and what do they do? And the simplest definition is that the monster is something that is outside of what's normal. And there are air quotes around so many words in that statement, because what is normal is really what we think, or the way we think things should be. And anything outside of that, then we define as monstrous. So that can be an animal that shouldn't exist in the natural world, again, using air quotes around natural. So things that are monster theorists like Noel Carroll talk about, things that are hybrid creations, different creatures mashed together, like the beasts in Daniel, the beast who has the head of a lion and the wings of an eagle, and things like that. Then there are also monsters that are really just moral monsters, that are like Hannibal Lecter or Norman Bates, that even though they look human, they don't have what we associate as the core value of empathy that makes us human. So we describe them as monsters. So I think monsters in so many different stories really give us the ability to look at, how do we define things as normal? What do we consider normal? And what does it look like when that gets threatened by something that comes from outside? The Bible is so fascinating because so many of these monsters are connected, as you mentioned, with Tiamat and Leviathan. Leviathan shows up. There are hints of Leviathan in Genesis 1, but then Leviathan's in a couple of the Psalms and back in Genesis. And then Leviathan becomes the red dragon in the book of Revelation. In the Greek translation of Leviathan, it's always the Drakon, the dragon. And so that gets picked up on in Revelation. And there are some other linguistic connections so that we know this is really the same thing. So it's kind of this idea of these creatures that are often representative of chaos, like you mentioned earlier, but that keep coming back and keep needing to be staved off to defend ourselves against that always encroaching chaos.
Yeah, I'm looking at my notes here. I've got 5 pages of notes for you, Brandon.
Oh, my.
That's too many notes. These are mostly just quotes from the book. But in terms of the monster, I think you made the connection that often they are connected to empire in the biblical text, which I found really interesting. But also that, again, it goes back to the context. One of the things, and I want to look at Michael Myers and Jason from Halloween and Friday the 13th, because you use those as an examples and how they represent a certain time in, especially in American culture and history. But I think for me, a really good example of how a monster reflects these anxieties is the original Godzilla. And there's this, it's obviously very clear that there's this connection to the bombings of, Hiroshima and
Absolutely.
Nagasaki. And there's even this frame in the original film where Godzilla is like rising above, and his head literally looks like a mushroom
A
cloud.
mushroom cloud. Yep.
But that one's easy. But the Michael Myers and Jason Voorhees of, Halloween and Friday the 13th are a little bit, they're different creatures. They're still monstrous, but they're a little bit
Sure.
different creatures. So maybe you can speak to these, because if I remember right, it's a scene in the second Friday the 13th movie that actually kind of launched your career in this
It did, yes.
way.
So my dissertation is called Reading Phineas, Watching Slashers, and it's based on Numbers 25. This is not something that I ever learned about in Sunday school or I've ever heard preached on. If any of your listeners are going to preach a sermon on Numbers 25, let me know so I can make sure to check it out. But it happens, the Israelites are wandering in the desert. They've just escaped Egypt and they're on their way to the Promised Land. And they start messing around with the foreign women. The foreign women often cause problems in the Bible. God tells them to knock it off. But then an Israelite man brings a Midianite woman into the camp and they go into the tent together. It seems like the implication is that they're going in to have sex while everybody else is standing around appalled. Moses doesn't know what to do. He's just kind of flabbergasted. But this priest named Phineas, who is Aaron's, I'm blanking out if it's son or grandson, one of Aaron's descendants, picks up a spear and runs into the tent and skewers them both. As I read this in graduate school, this is the exact same death scene that happens in Friday the 13th Part 2. And if you're a real geek, it also, Friday the 13th Part 2 bases all of its death scenes off the Mario Bava film Bay of Blood. So you can go back and check that out and compare them. So that was what really got me thinking about it and making that connection. And that to me launched me down this whole rabbit hole is what is the ideology of the slasher, and does that connect to the ideology of this story in Numbers 25, which I think is identified with the priestly tradition. You mentioned the J and the E strands earlier. One of the other strands is P, the priestly texts. For me, the slasher films, you look at who the slashers are killing. It's all the young people who are having sex, smoking pot, drinking, generally outside of the control of their parents. The parents all seem to be absent during these movies, and then they only finally show up at the end. So for me, the slasher is about this fear of loss of generational control, that these young people are out of control. And it's kind of a response to the 60s, the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War protests. You saw so many of these movies in the 70s that were really, really liberative and kind of working in an anti-establishment vein. And I see Halloween and these, especially the subsequent slashers, as being the resistance to that. They're really a product of the Reagan Revolution, saying, we need to reassert patriarchal control. We need to get these young people back in line and build our society back up again. And I think these movies are often confused enough that they don't quite know how to handle that because they want us to identify with Jason and Michael Myers up to a point, but they also realize that's deeply uncomfortable. So by the end, the police have to come in and take control of things. It's usually not the final girl who actually kills the slasher. It's usually the police, the psychiatrist, some representative of authority who comes back and sets everything right. And then the parents come in and we can reconstitute the family. And I see that as a similar kind of anxiety as what's working in these priestly texts, that they're written during the time of the exile. The temple in Jerusalem had been destroyed by the Babylonian army. The Israelites scattered, and they're trying to hold on to their identity and looking at how do we rebuild our communities? How do we establish that in the face of everything that we've encountered? So you have Phineas the slasher as the embodiment of patriarchal control reasserting itself.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly fascinating. And, you know, what I was thinking about while reading the book, especially within the context of our lives, you and I are both Generation X. And you often see memes about how Generation X was like the last wild generation where, you know, we could go out and play and, you know, just go home when the streetlights come on. Parents didn't know where we were, but it's interesting that how that stopped. And I was thinking in specifically about Halloween because it was in the late, I think it was like early 80s, but the movie, the original Halloween came out, I think 78 or 77,
78, yeah,
78,
yep,
78.
78.
That it wasn't that long after that that you started getting these rumors that, you know, Halloween wasn't safe because, you know, there's razor blades or drugs hidden in the candy and the apples and whatnot. And I thought, you know, that's really fascinating because what has happened since then is all of that control has come down on the children.
I found Stranger Things to be a fascinating series, and part of what I loved was connecting with the freedom that these kids had and remembering that from my childhood. I watched that with my own teens, and I think they were fascinated by it because it felt like this like foreign land that they couldn't believe. These kids were just like riding their bikes around all over the place and doing whatever they wanted to, and the parents were just these, kind of like almost spectral forces that just loomed around the edges of their lives, but hardly ever made an impact at all. Mostly they were just hanging around playing Dungeons and Dragons and biking all over town.
Well, you know, we know that Dungeons and Dragons will lead you straight to hell.
Absolutely. We've learned.
Yeah, I have that chick comic somewhere. But, and this kind of leads us to something a little bit different because if I remember right, you wrote in the book that you didn't really initially have a taste for the Friday the 13th movies because it just seemed to be just, you know, all about the murder, right? And I agree with that. And I believe that in our initial conversation, which was like 2 years ago, I had said that, you know, when I was younger, I loved gore and I've completely lost my taste for gore for the most part. And yet there was, you have a chapter on war. And that there was this emergence of films like Saw and Hostel that are connected to torture. And I see this sort of connection in a sense in that there's this complete and total disregard. And that, yeah. So anyway, I'm going to let you talk about that or ask you to
I think
speak
that's
more to that.
it's really interesting and unsettling. And again, the kind of torture movies of the early 2000s are among my least favorite of the horror genres. But I think there's still interesting stuff about them. As you mentioned, they came about right in the wake of Abu Ghraib, when we're realizing the enhanced interrogation techniques, euphemistically referred to, that our military is undergoing, that suddenly our military is engaged in all of these practices of figuring out how much can we push the boundaries and really redefine what torture is so that we can engage in some pretty horrible activities in the name of keeping all of us safe. And so suddenly these movies like Saw and Hostel come about. And there have always been horror movies that depict terrible things happening to people, but it seems like right at that moment is when a couple of these movies really lit the box office on fire. I feel like if either of those had come out 5 years earlier, they would have gone straight to video and no one would have paid much attention to them. I mean, there were many movies like that went straight to video, like Dee Snider's Strangeland in the late 90s, or things like that. So I do think it's kind of a in some way we're drawn to confronting that in a way that is kind of sideways, kind of slant, but still lets us maybe process some of what we're doing. I remember hearing an interview with Eli Roth, the writer director of Hostel, a while ago, where he talked about he'd learned in the mid 2000s that some troops who were stationed in Iraq told him that Hostel was one of their favorite movies. That the quote Roth conveyed was, "Yeah, we watch horrible things all day long. I just want to go home and see somebody get effed up."
Wow.
And yeah, it's maybe helping us process in a way that I worry isn't the most healthy way to process.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it sounds like they're saying it's a kind of catharsis, but my concern is just setting out this view of dehumanizing and
Absolutely.
not just, you know, the enemy or
Yeah.
anything, but
Yeah.
and I don't remember if I mentioned this in our previous conversation, but and I've never seen the movie, but I saw the trailer for The Human Centipede and the inhumanity in that, how it dehumanized people. I literally couldn't sleep all night when I saw the trailer because, and I think that it was like, that's when I'm like, oh yes, I have lost my taste for gore.
Yeah. This is
And
one of the few horror movies I have not seen either, because I saw the trailer and felt like that's enough. I don't know that I need more than that.
I was just concerned about how it just the dehumanization
Yeah.
and how the that and this is an ongoing debate as to whether media reflects society or if it leads society. And with something like that, maybe it's a little bit of both. I don't
I
know.
think it often is a bit of both, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then one of the things that slasher movies and I think the new torture movies make me think on too, I feel like especially the Friday the 13th movies really don't like people. It's not just that
Yeah.
they're dehumanizing them, but that the characters are
Yeah.
really awful, worthless people, and we're supposed to perceive them as terrible people, that because they're terrible people, we can kind of enjoy watching them get
Yeah.
messed up.
Yeah.
And that's not really a place that I want my head to be in for very
Right.
long.
Yeah. Well, I think horror has an incredibly valuable place to help us work through these things. It's
Yeah.
just sometimes it walks a fine line.
Absolutely. And you know, when I think whenever you're trying to do something challenging and difficult, you're gonna walk that fine line. So I try to keep that in mind when movies go what for me is over the line a little bit, that that's you're taking risks and trying to do something different,
For
and
sure.
sometimes it doesn't work and sometimes it does, but you got to take those risks.
Well, I like how you wrote in the book that part of it is also to see what we can, I forget the exact quote, but where our own personal boundaries are.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to think through and figure out. As a horror viewer, you have to determine that for yourself. Are you okay watching Saw? Are you okay watching, something more tame like Smile that still is, awfully bloody? And where is that for you? And then maybe think through why is that for you?
Good questions. Good questions. I've not seen Smile yet. I do, though, want to ask as well about you've got a chapter on body horror. And
Yeah.
body horror is one of those things where there's a lot of gore, but I still find myself fascinated. You mentioned David Cronenberg, who I always associate with body horror, especially The
Yeah.
Fly. But how does this body horror fit into a biblical context? And maybe say what body horror is too, for anyone who may not know.
So yeah, the Cronenberg is often thought of as the godfather of body horror. But for me, body horror is a movie that focuses intently on the ways the body can fall apart, the way the body is vulnerable, and specifically the way the body betrays us to do those things to itself. This book was written right before The Substance came out, or else that would have been the parade example of it, because that really is all about the way our body betrays us, first by aging, and then we see that turned into an elaborate, detailed, really visceral metaphor with all of the ways that these bodies are growing, changing, falling apart, doing all sorts of terrible things. So for me, the distinction between something like torture and something like body horror is that body horror is kind of the body revolting against the individual and doing it to yourself. So it body horror brings up all these really interesting questions about who am I and where am I, and do I really have control over my own body? And maybe how that control is more limited than I wish it was. So I talked about some places in Leviticus where I remember was at the Society of Biblical Literature a couple of years ago, where a scholar named Ryan Higgins, who fantastic scholar of Bible and horror, presented a paper where he had the main claim that in the priestly texts of the Pentateuch, God is disgusted by our bodies. And these texts then attempt to make us disgusted by our bodies too. The way that the boundaries are permeable, the way they ooze mucus and other liquids, and the way that we don't have control over them. Then I also connect that with some of the letters of Paul, where Paul talks about how I try to do the right thing and I can't always do it because there's something inside me that does something different. This idea that there are like warring factions within Paul. That we could see is just the light side and the dark side, which I think there's certainly some of that in there. But I also see it as Paul not having the control over himself that he wished he had.
I find it, I don't know. I didn't realize that God was disgusted by our bodies after making us, but there is definitely this trend, and not just in the Abrahamic traditions. You see this in even, like, to some extent, some of the Asian traditions, but even like New Age stuff, where there is this denial that the body isn't what you're supposed to focus on. And I've gotten myself to the point where I'm like, no, the body is important. And I'm curious if you are familiar with any body horror, where that's actually the message, where the message is we need to embrace all the pus and the ooze and the secretions and the falling apart.
I wonder if Cronenberg's Videodrome is one of the closest ones that it really looks at, they have all this talk about the new flesh, and it really begins to look at what are the possibilities of thinking about different bodies and thinking about beyond the body. Because I think we have been, ever since Platonism, before then, this idea that we have this mind body split, and that we have our bodies, but our soul is where we really reside, and that's really us. And body horror kind of pushes back on that a little bit, or at least complicates that, to say your body is you too. We care what happens to our bodies. And I do think that's a really interesting question. And would that kind of move through horror and into something different if we give a more hopeful idea of almost a post-humanism? What would that look like beyond our bodies?
So the Iron Man, the Japanese film, kind of, I think, is that sort of post-human vision in a sense.
Absolutely.
But I was also, one of the things I noted in regards to the body horror, and I've not seen The Substance. I know I need to watch it, but what came to my mind was an episode from the series Lovecraft Country. And it was specifically, and I don't remember the name of the episode, and I don't remember the name of the character, but it was the African American woman that was able to drink this potion that would turn her into a white woman. And but there was total body horror in that, because you saw, the change, and then how the flesh would have to rip apart and everything. And it seemed to me that that's a little bit of a different. It's using the genre of body horror, but saying something different too about the bodies that we are trapped in and the bodies that have privilege, I suppose.
That was where how society understands the bodies that we're trapped in, and how these bodies are given metaphorical, your word privilege is absolutely right.
And that's, anyway, let's, we're starting to run out of time here a little
Oh
bit.
no.
And there are a couple of things that I did want to talk about. One is, and we talked about this a little bit in our previous conversation, but I think we have to address it again. And this is the whole question of demons, demonic possession, because I believe we talked about The Exorcist, but you kind of added on to this, in the sense that it's interesting that it's almost always a female that is possessed in these films.
And that's Carol Clover in 1992, that her book Men, Women, and Chainsaws was like one of the books that launched me onto horror scholarship and made me realize that you could actually study these films. She has a book, a chapter called Her Body Himself, where she's talking about the how often in these movies the Reagan is the battlefield for this struggle between the demon and the priest. Reagan herself is really unimportant through the eyes of the movie. It's really about the priest's arc of belief, disbelief. And you see that play out over and over again in these movies where the female character who spends most of the movie being tormented, traumatized, and victimized herself is really treated as unimportant. And I think that's something to really pay attention to and try to push back on. That The Exorcist should be Reagan's story as much as this priest's crisis of faith.
Well, and it was interesting because, and I'm not sure how I want to frame this, but you mentioned the more recent Conjuring films. And those are fantastic movies, and they're based on the lives of Ed and Lorraine Warren. But this is something that. This is where I don't know how I want to frame this or phrase it because it goes a little bit beyond. But Ed and Lorraine Warren are so problematic in the sense that one of the, and I think that this was something that you mentioned before, was that when the original Exorcist came out, it was kind of public relations for the Catholic Church. And you started seeing all these people going to the church. And Ed and Lorraine Warren kind of did the same thing. You know, they never went into a alleged haunted house without finding demons there. And it seemed like they were just these public relation tools for the Catholic Church.
But then the Conjuring is really the movie franchise. They really come from an evangelical perspective, where the Catholic Church itself, its hierarchies are consistently ridiculed and proven to be ineffectual. So the idea would be you need a flat structure that can be more adaptive, responsive to the real evil that's in the world, and that's the evangelical church in this worldview.
Well, it's interesting. Did they make Ed and Lorraine evangelicals in that? Because Ed was
There's
very Catholic.
no, they're still Catholic, but
But they go out. Okay.
the Catholic Church is always ineffectual. Like they try to
Okay.
get the permission to do the exorcism in the first Conjuring, and they only get the permission after they've decided to go ahead and do it themselves. In The Curse of La Llorona, the main exorcist is a former priest who has been excommunicated from the Catholic Church.
But you also noted that the main issue, kind of, I think, in the first Conjuring movie is about the family. So it's not about anyone's test of faith so much, but it's about the absence of the father, which kind of goes back to that patriarchal idea, of course.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, that Ed Warren in the first Conjuring, he helps not only by getting rid of the demon, or the ghost, or however you perceive it, the entity that is possessing and haunting, but also by helping teach the dad how to fix his car and making waffles for everybody. The waffle making seems equally important to the exorcism. In the second one, he's got to play guitar and sing Elvis songs.
Well, that one was on the Enfield Poltergeist case, right? Yes, the person I met that has convinced me to move to England is lives in Enfield. And I don't think that they appreciated when they first said that they lived in Enfield. I'm like, oh, that's where the poltergeist
Like, oh, great. Yeah, thanks.
And I've been there a couple times and I've never sought out the building, but part of me wants to.
You'll have a chance now, yeah.
So we're running out of time. I was going to ask you about folk horror, but I can just like tell people go read the book.
I
But
appreciate that, yeah.
yes, and I do encourage people to read the book. It's a fun read and it's a very accessible read. But I do have a
Good.
question that isn't addressed in the book, but I thought I wanted to ask you this. And because you look at horror as a genre and that the Bible's made up of all these genres, but I was curious about the Bible in horror as the book itself. And what I mean by that is that sometimes books play a central role in horror. So, like in the Evil Dead, and that's I will still watch Evil Dead movies. That's where my gore comes in. But you
I
have the
love those.
Necronomicon, and there's also like grimoires and whatnot. What about the Bible itself as a horror text.
So the book to read for this is Steve Wiggins' book, Holy Horror. It's all about the Bible as talisman in horror movies, and the way how the Bible gets used as a way to protect against evil, how sometimes its words have power, but sometimes it's really just a talisman, that the Bible itself, when you hold it up and stand it in between you and evil, has power. So yeah, I think there's both the text within the Bible, but as a cultural artifact, the Bible, with all caps and all of the reverence that that entails, is something else entirely. And I think one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is help us to see that there is the Bible, the big picture thing, and also the Bible, which includes the stories, poems, laws, prophecies, all the things in it. And we should be careful not to mix those two up. Make sure we're sorting them out.
For sure. So, is there anything, I know there's a lot in the text that we haven't addressed, but is there anything that you feel that is important that you would like to add or maybe tease to get people a little bit more interested?
Well, I appreciated you saying how readable and how much fun it was. That was really what I was going for. I've written several books that have, sold less than 100 copies to libraries around the world. But like my revised dissertation, I'm not sure my mom could get through it. It has so many footnotes and it's so dense. And that's often what we do as scholars, is we write books like that that are for other scholars and that graduate students will find and get through interlibrary loan. And then you can see yourself in a footnote and do a little happy dance when you've been cited. That's great. But I really wanted to find a way to present these ideas to people who aren't scholars, who are interested in these things, but maybe, yeah, don't want to have to get a PhD to understand some of the literature. So I appreciated that. And I really hope that this book will speak to people who are both people of faith and horror fans, but also people who are horror fans and don't really have an affiliation with organized religion. I think that's fine too. Or people who consider themselves religious but really aren't horror fans. I hope it will still be interesting in that it can help us become both better readers of the Bible and better watchers of horror movies, and that it can work in both of those directions.
Okay, wonderful. So let me ask you the final questions. One is, what do you got coming up? What are you working on next?
So yeah, books have long enough lives to get from a manuscript into publication that I've actually got an academic monograph with Oxford University Press that's just gone into production. It's called Concerning Dust and Ashes: Affects of Horror in the Hebrew Bible. So it's one of those books with more footnotes than pages, but asking the question about what happens if we analyze the horror texts less from their narrative structure and more from the affects they try to create. And can those, the emotions that they try to instill, the physical responses they try to give, and can those responses be part of the meaning? Can that be part of how we get to concepts that we might ignore if they were just presented rationally, or that we might not be willing to accept them because they seem either far outside the bounds of what we can think, or too contradictory, or just maybe too frightening. So if the text can make us feel those emotions, can it get us there in a different way? So I'm working on that. I've got a number of essays in process, including one for Jeffrey Jerome Cohen's 30th anniversary of the Monster Theory volume, the original volume that started off Monster Theory as an academic discipline.
Wonderful. I do have
Yeah.
one other question I'm going to throw in before
Sure.
I ask where you can go. And this is an easy one. So it's been 2 years since we've talked before. Do you have any favorite horror films that have come out in the past 2 years?
In the past 2 years, I mean, we are still in kind of a golden era of horror. There have been a lot of really good things that come out. If Sinners is the best horror movie that comes out this year, I mean, that would be a pretty good year. I think there are still some amazing folk horror movies coming out, like Starve Acre that came out a couple of years ago. I found just mesmerizing. A Spanish movie called The Coffee Table that messed me up.
Mm-hmm.
Not because it's overly gory or anything, but yeah, I recommended it to a friend and he told me he was going to send me his therapy bills after watching that one.
Okay.
So yeah, I think there have been so many good ones,
Yeah.
and I feel excited to be around now and be a horror scholar at this time when there's so much good stuff happening.
Yeah, I need to see Sinners and the other one, that Starve Acre, is that what it was
Starve
called?
Acre, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'll look into that. I don't know
Yeah,
about the
it's
coffee table. I may look into
the Starve Acre is
Yeah.
fantastic British folk horror.
Okay,
Yeah.
yeah. I do like the folk horror. I was very fond of, except for like the very ending, Late Night with the Devil. I really
It did
appreciated
go
it.
a little get a little off the rails at the end, but
Yeah.
it's a lot of fun, and I
Yeah.
enjoyed what it tried to do with the medium. And
Yeah,
yeah, I
yeah.
thought that one was just fun.
Yeah, when I thought it was interesting that they put it into the context at the very beginning of the 70s itself, at this
Yeah,
time of
exactly.
turmoil, you know.
Yeah,
But I haven't
yeah.
looked too, I haven't thought too deeply about, well, what is this actually saying about that period of time?
Yeah.
So,
I had a podcast discussion on the Fear of God podcast that was all about Late Night with the Devil, where we spent an hour trying to unpack it. I don't know how
All right.
successful we were, but
Yeah,
it was fun.
it's been a few months. I couldn't do that right now. So, where can people go to find out more about you and your work and
Yeah.
keep track of the books that you have coming out?
So my website, BrandonRGrafius.com. I try to keep current and do a blog post a couple of times a month to update or just give some thoughts, but also try to keep it updated for books and publications and articles and things like that. So you can see the full list of everything I've published. Coming soon, I'll be having a bunch of events for the launch of Scared by the Bible. So I'll be updating that with a calendar of some events if you're in the Michigan area, or some of them will be online that maybe you'll be able to jump onto those as well. I've decided there were too many Nazis on Twitter for my taste, so I've
Yeah, me
kind of
too.
jumped off X, but I still am pretty active on Blue Sky and
Okay.
Facebook. I use as a way to keep people updated on what I'm doing too.
Okay, perfect. I know you and I are friends on Facebook, so
I think so, yeah.
So I will put links for your website. I'll try to get social media, but definitely also links for the new book. I'll put
Yeah,
those in the
awesome.
show notes in the video description.
Very
So,
cool.
Brandon, it was wonderful to reconnect. As before, I feel like we could just have this sort of ongoing conversation,
Absolutely.
because I love horror and I love religious studies and biblical studies. So it really is an amazing opportunity to speak to someone who merges those in such a
Yeah.
fascinating and interesting way.
It's such a great conversation, Nick. Thanks so much for having me on again.
And that's a wrap on episode 208 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you are part of my YouTube audience. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button if you're watching on YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now, I have over 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 13 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe. It's totally free, and it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love. I do love it, but it is a lot of labor. So if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little love my way. With more subscriptions and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship, and honestly, having some funds come my way to help with equipment, hosting, and other necessary subscriptions would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also purchase a Super Thanks on YouTube to help support my work. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.